Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of From the Backburner Podcast. I'm Jonathan O'Dell, your host. And I want to start off by giving a shout out to my sponsor, Birch Barrel. I can't tell you how much fun I have cooking with this thing and thinking about ways to use it and all the different variety of methods. We had the cold days are fastly coming to an end here in America, and you'd be surprised. We had a big cold front come through Arizona about a week ago and dropped the temperatures, and I was actually glad I had that Birch Barrel that I could instead of cooking on it, actually use it for a fire to be outside and burn some mesquite wood and stay warm while I was outside hanging out for a little bit. So if you're interested in getting yourself a Birch Barrel, visit birchbarrel.com. Check out everything they have. They have a big social media presence, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok even. Check them out. A lot of ways you can use it. Recipes, you name it. But you can use my promo code Burner, B-U-R-N-E-R, at checkout for a 10% discount. Check them out again at birchbarrel.com. Well, this podcast has been months and months and months in the making. It was my guest today was one I was trying to get on actually very early when I was first starting. And he and I are always seem to be kind of running in opposite directions sometimes. And so we sat down for a couple minutes, and then all of a sudden he needed to make it somewhere for a meeting and bailed off. And so now I finally coaxed him into joining me today. So joining me from North Carolina, the beautiful state of North Carolina today is a man who really almost doesn't need an introduction. He has a large presence for a long time out there, author, journalist, writer, outdoorsman, T. Edward Nickens, or Eddie as we all like to call him. Hey, Eddie.
How you doing, man?
I am super good today. I'm glad we could finally get you on today. So,
yeah, it's been almost a year since we tried to herd these cats. We're glad it worked out.
Well, and it was about another year, almost two, before that when you and I were hanging out in the southern Arizona deserts chasing rabbits. So,
man, what a big time that was. I know we'll talk about that. That was still great memories.
Well, for listeners who don't know, Eddie is a I don't want to steal your thunder. You've got such like a byline. I know you're an editor at large for Field and Stream, contributing editor to Garden and Gun, Audubon, Ducks Unlimited. You've contributed articles to so many different places. He's a New York Times bestselling author. How many books at this count now, Eddie, do you have? Is it seven, eight?
I think it's six, Jonathan.
Is it six?
I'm looking over at my bookshelf, but I think about six. The first one, the New York Times one that you referred to, was the original Total Outdoorsman. And then we had a couple iterations of the Total Outdoorsman, and then last year had an anthology published, a collection called The Last Wild Road. And then in April, I'll have the latest of the Total Outdoorsman series will come out, the Total Camping Manual, in association with Field Streams. So, yeah, it's been a fun ride.
It's cool that you kind of have carried on that tradition of Field and Stream, I guess, like compendium books. You know, that I have some on my bookshelf. I know I sent you a picture of one that you hadn't even heard of before. That Field and Stream, over its history, has every once in a while one of the editors or something will compile a book of, you know, the best hunting stories or aspects and kind of, you know, put it out there for folks.
Yeah, you know, when we sat down to do the first one, we realized when I grew up, as I was growing up, there were tons of these books, the complete book of outdoor lore by Outdoor Law. There were all of the, if you remember, the Deer Hunter's Bible, the Hunter's Bible, the Archer's Bible. There was this little industry of these how-to books. And I don't know, you know, in the 90s, 80s, they seemed to kind of go by the wayside. People were looking for information delivered in a different way. So there weren't a lot of them published. And it was fun when Field & Stream sat down to come up with a really modern way of publishing a how-to book. To be there at sort of the beginning of that and help craft what that could all look like. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I was a little concerned when you put out the recent book, The Last Wild Road. I didn't know, because of the title, I didn't know if that was an ominous name of, hey, I'm saying goodbye and this is kind of my farewell piece or not.
No farewell piece at all. The Last Wild Road was the name of a great story. But no, I'm sticking around. I'm not going anywhere.
Well, with that, you know, I mean, obviously, they say that, you know, if you're a writer, you also tend to be a reader, I'm sure you, in your spare time, find enough time to be able to read quite a bit. Are there three books that you would recommend to folks? I know books sometimes seem to have fallen out of favor with you know, social media and the new kind of way of getting information. But are there three outdoor books that you would recommend to my listeners?
Three outdoor books. I'll tell you who a very important writer for me was, two of them. The first would be John McPhee. And so I would say any of his collected works in terms of just, and they're not necessarily outdoor books, but he writes, McPhee is a writer for The New Yorker and a professor at Princeton University. And his way of approaching nonfiction is pretty spectacular. You know, and I read fiction. Jim Harrison. I'd say go to any of the great Jim Harrison books. The Beast That God Forgot to Invent would be one title from Jim Harrison that I would suggest reading. That was one of the epigrams in The Last Wild Road. Was a line from Jim Harrison that said, "If I can get it right, the danger of civilization, of course, is that we will piss away our lives on nonsense." So. Kind of hard not to appreciate that perspective.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Very cool. You know, you have I don't want to date you here. I know you. I mean, you've been around a long time, writing and covering stories. And
yeah, I've been around long enough now that I've gotten past really caring if people know how long I've been around. Yeah, I went freelance and I had one job out of college that lasted about 2.5 years. But I've been freelance writing since 1988.
Now, 1988.
Yeah, put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Well, I think I've probably been reading your articles since about then. To date my own self, seeing your byline around. So you've traveled around the world, hunted a lot of different places, a lot of different things. Is there one place in particular that stuck with you, one hunting or fishing kind of expedition that really, you know, was unforgettable?
Wow. I mean,
of course, aside from hunting with me, I mean, you know.
Well, you know, we'll set that aside. We'll put that under my script later. I mean, there have definitely been unforgettable moments, Jonathan. As for a particular place, there is a particular place that I have wanted to return to for about 15 years, and I never have. I'm not going to say the name of the river, but it's a river in the Northwest Territories that I only spent a day on, but it was one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. And the thought of paddling in and spending a week feeding yourself pike and ducks is something that is going to get done here in the next few years. I'm convinced of it. That's the one place that I kind of wake up thinking I have to go back there. I've got to go back there.
Pike and duck sound like a pretty good duo to put together on a plate for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be a lot of fun. It would be a lot of fun. I love, you know me, I love cooking ducks and I love, and I've eaten a lot of pike. I enjoy pike too.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you a fan of the pickled pike?
You know, where I live down here in the balmy South, pickled pike is not exactly on an everyday plate. But I like pickled meats. So I'd say I would like a pickled pike. We're getting ready to start into the shad season right now. As a matter of fact, I just put a coat of marine epoxy on a new John boat floor that I've cut out. And shad is one of those sort of pike like fishes in regards to folks turn their nose up at the taste and the thought of eating these bony things. But you know, folks like you and I, that's just a good challenge to take.
For sure. So, you know, aside from covering outdoor writing, I mean, you've had your fair share of recipes and things that you've produced and put out there in different magazines. Is there any that you're like most proud of?
I'm most proud of changing people's minds, I think. I just two nights ago, last day of quail season in North Carolina was Monday. So on Sunday night, I was at a quail lodge where I'd been before, and they were disparaging the duck as a table bird. And I told them the next time I came that I'd cook duck for them and change their minds. And I did. I had two redheads from North Dakota and a couple of really nice fatty mallards from Mississippi. Cooked them simply, but I'll tell you, everybody walked away shaking their heads saying they'd never had anything like it. And I'm not saying that means that I'm a great waterfowl cook. It means there are a lot of really, really crappy waterfowl cooks out there. But those kinds of recipes that really, really stick out are the ones where people go, damn, that was good. I didn't even think it was going to be edible, and that was great.
Yeah. I actually enjoy, changing people's minds and stuff like that. I hearken back to when you and I first, contacted each other and talked, was after the second win for the Arizona BHA chapter there, and for the cook-off, and that particular meal was jackrabbit, rattlesnake, and cactus. And I know when Arizona's BHA chapter, is pretty serious about the cook-offs and stuff. And when they invited me to join the team and help them out that second year to try and make a win, and I broached the subject. I said, okay, you know, we were trying to figure out what to cook and what everyone has in their freezers and what's available to us. And I started thinking about, you know, all the other teams we're up against and what they bring to the table. And I said, you know, I said, here's a crazy idea. Why don't we cook the worst things we've got, or things that people think, you know, have a misconception about that, you know, hunters would even turn their nose up to. And I said, you know, jackrabbit's one of the main ones. And then I said, you know, rattlesnake and cactus. I mean, you know, people wouldn't imagine, you know, these three things all together on a plate for a meal. And obviously it worked. Changing hearts and minds is absolutely right when it comes to cooking something a little different, you know?
Yeah, that sounds like sort of the unholy trinity of Arizona there. but you know, I also applaud the way that you approach cooking in one particular respect, trying to marry, you know, a local game animal or fish with some sort of local plant, something else that you bring to the table that speaks of a sense of place. I think that helps people understand that, you know, we're not trying to get fancy, but we're trying to sort of elevate the approach to wild game cooking, and not into the stratosphere, but definitely away from the Campbell's cream and mushroom soup can.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you've had a chance to kind of watch this over the years, this transition, I guess, or what I kind of like to refer to as this resurgence or renaissance of wild game cooking here in America that's taken hold and really transforming something we haven't seen since the market hunting days. You know, what it means to have game on your plate. Do you have any thoughts on kind of what you've been seeing and
But I've been seeing people willing to just throw everything out that they thought they knew about cooking in terms of how to sear and what's the right temperatures and how long to cook, and just look at wild game not as an extension of the kind of cooking that they've been doing for all of their lives, but as something totally different that you approach with a totally fresh perspective, and without preconception. And that's been, I think, sort of the fuel in the rocket. People are not trying to cook wild game like they cook everything else. They realize it's its own thing. And the other thing is, I think there's still this sense of it can be everyday food as well. And that's one thing we have to be careful about as we're presenting wild game cooking, in my opinion. You know, the cook-offs like BHA does, some of these events they're fabulous. And it shows how far you can push the envelope with wild game cuisine. But, you know, yesterday for lunch, I dumped 7 dove breasts in a saucepan with a jar of the cheapest barbecue sauce I had and simmered it for an hour and ate it for lunch. There was nothing elevated about that. It was every day food, which up until the last 10 years is what this stuff was anyway. So I do think we have to be careful. I think you get this with the pushback sometimes with a venison backstrap. If you try to do something different with a venison backstrap and you're stuffing it with jalapenos, you're marinating it. Yeah, we'll run these recipes in the magazine and we'll always hear from somebody, "Oh, you ruined all you need is salt and pepper." Well, yeah, if you're going to eat one backstrap a year, but if you're going to eat 8, then you've got to have some variety.
Right. Right. No, I've seen a little bit of the, you know, obviously some folks can really push the boundaries of what, you know, we thought game meat could be and could do. And you're right. I mean, kind of throwing all what you know about cooking out the window. I mean, you know, Gordon Ramsay's perfect steak of, you know, sear and then into the oven, only works because, you know, all the cows and the steaks are from cows that are exactly the same age and the exact same thing. And where you might have a hatch year mallard, or you might have a mallard that's 8 years old and they don't, certainly that time and energy you're putting into cooking, that 8-year-old mallard could cook for a whole lot longer than that 8-month-old mallard, you know, in terms of tenderness and juiciness and everything else. So, I found that, yeah, I mean, probably the biggest thing for me is just how much time I devote to, you know, every animal I'm cooking, because everyone's different. They don't all come out the same. It's I often go back to the traditional squirrel and gravy recipe, fried squirrel and gravy. You know, the big secret that I think everyone kept hidden for a long time is you got to have young of the year squirrels versus the old ones that have a little more toughness, you know, if you're going to try that dish with it. So,
yeah. And I think it's fun how we sort of, man, I don't know how you do your freezers. I've got 2 freezers, and man, I am I am very careful in labeling, but if I'm going to go to the trouble of shooting it and dragging it and bringing it home and hauling it in here to the laundry table outside my office and butcher it, I go to some trouble to label everything correctly and put it away so I know where things are, like a venison backstrap. If I cut a venison backstrap into three pieces, I label which is which. So I'll know, you know, there's one end is better than the other. And taking that kind of care about the wild game, I think people are really sort of into that. And that's going to result in a better product on the table every time.
Yeah, and I do enjoy, you know, I think for a while it was, and not to certainly disparage any processors, but a lot of times, you know, when folks would take an animal to a processor, you kind of get the standard fare of cuts and you know, products afterwards, so much grind, so much sausage, so, you know, whatever you want to do. But when you kind of do the butchering yourself, you have this freedom to be like, okay, you know, maybe I want a different cut that I haven't had before. You know, I see a lot more of rib-on backstraps that folks are kind of experimenting with and playing with. So that's to me is always kind of fun too. Is some of the different cuts that you may not. And I love whole cuts. I mean, just recently I was hanging out with Johan Magnusson, a big Swede, and I had an entire bone-in ham off a Coos whitetail deer you know, he was talking to me. I said, yeah, let me bring some game over. And he's like, what do you got? And I'm checking through the freezer. And I was like, man, I got this whole ham. He's like, do you want to break it into pieces? And I was like, why would we do that? Let's just barbecue the whole bone in ham and give that a shot. See what we can do with that. And it's turned out beautifully. You had some different texture to the cuts we were having out of the meat and stuff. So, it was fun to experiment and play with.
Yeah. And I encourage folks to, I mean, the butchering can be off-putting. There's no doubt. And I don't know, Jonathan, if it's a geographic thing or not, but in the South, I live in North Carolina, very few people butcher their own deer. I don't know what it's like in Arizona, in another sort of hot climate. You know, it can be 85 degrees here during parts of deer season. And so you do have to plan ahead, but I don't know what the percentages are, but I'd guarantee you 9 out of 10 deer go to a processor. And I started butchering my own deer years ago. I mean, it's something that I plan for. You know, it takes 4 hours by the time I get it in the house and wash all the knives at the end of the process. But it's something I look forward to. I enjoy it. And you're right, that notion of planning for different cuts, thinking about different meals as you're going through the process. It's something I'd never do it any other way.
Yeah. I didn't want to let this slide because you just made a quick little comment about knives. During our hunt together, I found out, I think, I don't know how big of a secret it is, but you're a bit of a purveyor or connoisseur of fine knives.
I do like a good blade. I always have to tell folks, you have to understand, I get sent a lot of good knives. So it makes it a little easier to be a connoisseur. But yeah, I have gotten to the point to where I'm just not going to use a crappy knife. I'll carry knives with me if I think I'm going to be doing any cutting or butchering or cooking it all on an assignment. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess a tag along question to that is what do you look for, in a good knife? Like, as far as you're concerned, what makes a good knife? And of course we have a lot of different areas that knives fit into, you know, your kitchen fare, or your butchering knives, or, you know, your field knives. Is there anything in particular like you look for in a knife, or is it just kind of all across the map?
Well, I do across categories, I'd say the very first thing I look for is the steel. Is what is the steel that's used in the knife? I mean, there's just so many amazing steels, and there's some really, really great older traditional steels that there's just no reason to buy a knife with crappy steel. And so that's one of the first things that I look at. I like buying knives from local knife makers that maybe are on the up and coming and aren't super well known, so I don't have to pay a whole lot of money for them. But you know, to pay for a lot of people to pay $250 for a culinary knife, they think you're nuts when you can, you know, for $29.99 you can buy a set of eight at the Walmart. But it's just not a lot of money when you think about how much it's going to be in your hand, you day after day, week after week, year after year. So I have put together a pretty fun collection of culinary knives. And I've got a bunch of field knives. But I like using sort of one field knife for just about everything. My everyday carry knife is my deer skinning knife, my wedding cake cutting knife, my pick my toes knife, you name it. It just feels wonderful in my hand. And so I do like finding that one knife that you feel like, you know, you can just live with.
Yeah. I personally, one of my best field knives, and I like it because of the belly and that's on the knife and everything, and it's super affordable. But the Mora knives, which are very inexpensive and all that, they have been a great field knife as far as a multi-purpose, you know, use out in the field knife and stuff. I've done so much, you know, butchering, skinning, different things with them. They're just great as far as I'm concerned. You know, I've got a few knives that are, I spent a divorce level of money, in Japan, a number of years ago, I wanted a chef's knife from one of the really well-known manufacturers in Tokyo, that's an old family that made swords for the samurais and stuff and continued on bladesmithing and all that. But I wanted a really good chef's knife from them, that single bevel edge, real thin Japanese steel. So thankfully, my wife didn't know how much I spent until the credit card bill came in later. But still use it to this day. It's a fantastic knife. But switching gears a little bit. So the reason why I know Eddie has a fascination with knives, aside from the fact that he actually has a knife book as well. But when Eddie and I went out to the field to go rabbit hunting, I had a case pocket knife that I pulled out, and he kind of eyeballed it and was looking around to see exactly what I was carrying. Did that tell something to you about me, Eddie, or?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You don't see a lot of case knives out there. And it's not a knife that I have a particular affinity for. I'm trying to remember what knife that was. It was like a trapper style, three blade. Yeah.
Yeah, with the sheep's foot.
Yeah. For me personally, I get nervous without a lockback. And that probably has as much to do with the fact that I'm clumsy as anything. But you know, I don't know that it said anything about you. Your choice of rifles, I found interesting. Not the models, but that you carried these two rifles for different purposes different uses out there. That told me you, A, were serious about old Mr. Jackrabbit, and B, that you really knew what you were doing, and you showed that. You showed that for sure.
Yeah, that the infamous Jack Whacker and the Jack Hammer, two purpose built 22 rifles just for hunting jackrabbits out there in the desert. Cause you're running into different terrains. And so I've got a red dot optic on the one for close, quick shots when everything's thick. And then I've got the scoped out rifle for a little bit more distance when you saw we were down there. I mean, some of those rabbits were breaking, on us, you know, at a good distance. So.
Yeah, I was impressed with that hunt. That was a lot of fun. And, you know, some of that hunting was pretty tough with those high winds, but man, I enjoyed every bit of it. That was a kick. That was a kick. And it was fun for us talking about this sort of fascination with small game and sort of the historical context for some of that. Camping out under the desert, man, cooking jackrabbits in the ground. That's good living there.
Yeah. Just throwing jackrabbits in a Dutch, burying it with a bunch of coals and going out to hunt for a little while, coming back to a hot meal. And it's kind of the life sometimes, you know. I really enjoy that quite a bit. What's sad is like right after that hunt, obviously, COVID struck. And actually it was already kind of starting, I think, when you had come out and we were hearing the early, you know, I think because it was February, I believe. And, you know, we were hearing the early ramifications of, hey, there's a you know, virus going around affecting people and all that. And then wouldn't you know it, right after that, the rabbits got hit with the disease of their own, rabbit hemorrhagic disease type 2.
In the area that we were hunting.
That hit the Southwest. It started in New Mexico and kind of lit on a wildfire. It hit cottontails and blacktails and antelope jacks and you name it. I mean, it was the first time in this country that I think we'd seen that disease. So really took off like a wildfire. I know it made it out, I think almost to Kansas and burned up into Nevada and California. Just, I mean, every place in between.
What kind of losses were you looking at?
Oh, it was significant. There were lots and lots of rabbits. RHDV2 was something completely new, and it was 5 days from infection to death. It was a really fast killer. And then of course I had to go on the radio and right at Easter time to talk about the rabbit disease, which was just kind of. Wouldn't you know the timing, you know?
Oh, man, that's tough. Yeah, it's been a couple of years of sort of learning how to handle this new reality, you know. And I don't know if this is anything you want to, you know, get into, but the notion of, you know, the future of wild game as a safe food resource, you know. Yeah. I think those are conversations we're going to start having.
Yeah. You know, obviously the pandemic, you know, when folks were trying to social distance and stay away from everyone, they all went out to the woods and there was just this huge influx of people that, you know, aside from your normal hunting cadre that you have every year, there was, you know, the guys who were maybe the once every 5 years or whatever, and they all kind of went out to the field together. I mean, I was hearing reports from a number of states with, you know, turkey tag sales just exploding and mm-hmm. you know, more folks out in the woods and, you know, just kind of getting back to hunting. And I don't know if it was based on a food security or just, you know, hey, I'm tired of, you know, being stuck at home and I'd much rather be walking around out in the woods with a gun or something.
Yeah, it might have been as much the latter as anything else, but then they discovered what a good old bushy tail tastes like and gloves are off.
For sure. It's kind of a weird paradox in a way that, you know, a lot of times I think folks for a while were trained to think of wild game as diseased or, you know, like, you know, they would constantly overcook game, I think is what it was because it, you know, it was from the outside and it was dirty and things like that. And the reality of it is a lot of times you end up ruining, game meat by overcooking it like that. But now it's almost seen as kind of a safer meat source.
For sure. you know, I jokingly tell folks, you know, I'm a vegetarian. I just eat acorns that have been highly processed through the four chambers of a deer stomach. You know, but when you look at it that way, I mean, you're sort of ingesting the wild when you're partaking of wild game. I think it's a really healthy, balanced approach to doing what we do.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, if people, you know, kind of look at this pandemic as well, and, you know, obviously the origins of this virus was kind of in question, and it was zoonotic in nature, you know, jumping from, you know, one species into the human, which is what classifies a zoonotic disease. You know, in the past, there's things like, you know, bird flu and you know, avian influenza, swine flu, a lot of those things. And so our relationship with diseases and things like that, as it relates to wild animals as well as domestic, you know, is it's interesting to say the least, you know, of how the thought process is. I mean, that's why, you know, at least with migratory birds, they travel, you know, probably the globe second only to humans in terms of a source for transmission of things. So,
yeah, I think the question is still unanswered as to how ultimately this notion of wildlife disease is going to play out within the hunting and fishing world. I mean, it's certainly something we've seen with chronic wasting disease, you know, and coronavirus as well, showing up in wild deer populations. I mean, that's going to be something that we're all sort of watch really, really closely here over the next few years.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we've had a lot of wildlife specific diseases, you know, the chronic wasting disease and EHD and a number of things that have, you know, taken their toll in certain parts of the country, with deer populations and things like that. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the RHDV2 that kind of hit the Southwest and rabbits and, things like that. It's, you know, certainly something to that we watch and monitor for, has an impact, you know, long term as well as short term. I mean, you know, some of my favorite rabbit honey holes are a little scarce these days until, you know, we have hopefully a few good years to bring them back, as well as I know, you know, folks in the Dakotas who had that EHD breakout of in deer and things like that. Wasn't there something out your neck of the woods too, in the not too recent past? Or,
well, there's been a lot of concern over coronavirus showing up in white-tailed deer populations. Most of that work, I believe, has been done in Pennsylvania and in the Northeast. But I can't think of any other issues, you know, other than we're all going to be taken away by ticks and chiggers before the end of the world comes. But
well, and that's it, you know, that's a whole nother thing, you know, that was kind of has lost its prominence a little bit, but there was the alpha gal disease from Lone Star ticks that, you know, folks who got bit by them suddenly were allergic to red meat.
Yeah. It'd be pretty prominent if you were a victim of that. That's for sure.
Well, and it's my understanding, a friend of mine, his wife, got bit, and had to develop the allergies and stuff. But I guess, in learning through him that it kind of affects everyone a little differently. So there's some meats or some proteins that are okay for some people, not for others. And so he had to kind of learn a whole new way of cooking for his wife. He'd end up cooking two different meals for dinner, you know, one for his wife and one for him and his kids. So, certainly challenging. Well, hey, I wanted to mention, you know, if Eddie isn't busy enough writing in his fortress of solitude there, he's joining me from today. It's giving back. You have another avenue or title that you have. You're a board member for the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Board of Directors.
Yeah. I've been on the board for, I believe, 6 years. Jonathan, I've been secretary of the executive committee of the board for two terms, been in my second term with that now. And that has been, that has been one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. Certainly because it put me into contact with you. That's definitely the greatest benefit of that relationship. But it has been, it's been something I'm super passionate about. And I've worked with a lot of conservation organizations over the years, and not to take anything away from all their great work, but like a lot of BHA members, I did feel like I found my people. That's a phrase you hear a lot within the BHA community. And I definitely felt that way when I fell in with that crowd and with Lan Tawney, who I knew and had worked with when he was with the National Wildlife Federation before he moved over to BHA. That's been an awesome experience.
Well, yeah, and I'm 6 years, obviously, you know, you've been able to see a lot of this transition and ground that BHA has made, you know, much kind of the same way I was. It really opened my eyes, I think, you know, when I first went up to Rendezvous there in Boise and you know, just to see what was going on and the diversity of folks. And that was really, honestly, that's kind of the encapsulating word of what just punched me in the face when I walked in at Boise was diversity. You know, it was diversity in so many ways. I mean, of political thought, gender, ethnicity, and just age. There was a lot of young people, some older people. It was kind of a good mix versus, you know, I think what you see, kind of the stereotypical idea of the, you know, the old white guy that seems to dominate, most hunting circles. This was kind of new and fresh, and just, you know, I was trying to take it all in the midst of cooking a meal and just enjoying my time there with the events and stuff at that annual get together. So
yeah, it's been fun to see on that diversity piece the geographic range sort of expand as well. I believe I was the first national or North American board member from the East, certainly from the South. And I think that was one of the reasons Lan wanted me to be involved, was to help that organization grow its identity, I suppose. And we've seen that be super, super successful, very, very strong chapters in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic, in the Southeast. That's been something I've been really proud to play a small role with that.
Yeah, I think it helped to educate me as well as you did. I mean, as well as I remember my time fondly in North Carolina when I was there at Fort Bragg with the Army, and I got out to hunt a few times there. Hunting with shotguns was kind of a new experience for me, but it solidified my mindset of shot sizes. You know, when you talk about buckshot, okay, that's actually, you know, the reason why it's called buckshot is for deer. I was like, oh, okay, you know, I just thought, oh, okay, you know, some old West term or something like that. No, it's actually for hunting deer. And but the amount of public lands in North Carolina, you know, I mean, when I think a lot of people here in the West consider, you know, like we just have vast open expanses of public lands. And you start, you know, thinking about, you know, states in the East or, you know, where it's mostly, you know, private, and actually there's quite a bit of public land, there in the East and in the South.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, here in North Carolina, we have 2 million acres of public hunting and fishing lands, 1 million acres of national forest, a part of that. We've also got 2 million acres of estuarine waters, of sounds on the coast. We got the most estuarine waters than any other lower 48 state than Louisiana. So 4 million acres of public lands and public waters to roam around on and hunt and fish is not an insignificant amount.
No, that's not all potatoes.
No, you know, and I live in Raleigh. I mean, I live in a big city. And a lot of people are surprised at what a rich heritage we still have of hunting and fishing I'm only 2.5 hours from the coast. So, I mean, there is a very, very strong, strong tradition of saltwater fishing and duck hunting in the coastal marshes. But, you know, there's this growing interest in sort of, it wasn't niche at the time, but, you know, small game hunting, squirrel hunting, rabbit hunting, all these other ways of expressing that love of the outdoors. So, yeah, so I really appreciate the fact that the West is this iconic space with these big charismatic animals that we aspire to pursue. But I tell the folks in North Carolina, I tell the folks in the South, we don't play second fiddle to anybody when it comes to our love of the pursuit of the wild, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and I think that's what I appreciate probably the most about the South is kind of over the last 100 years in the South. There's been a lot of transition in hunting and things like that, and you know, the South kind of really almost epitomized the standard bearer of carrying hunting, you know, forward and all that, where, you know, a lot of the big game stuff was lost, you know, towards the end of market hunting and all that. And you know, you were lucky if you saw deer tracks, let alone a deer in the South for a long time. And so small game hunting like rabbits and quail and squirrels and stuff kind of carried hunters, you know, through that lean time until a lot of the successes in conservation came about and bringing back white-tailed deer and turkeys and things like that we kind of know today, where, you know, the big game in the West really, you know, never hit that point. And so being in the West, you know, I'm very aware of, you know, how big game centric I think a lot of the hunting is in the West and how much opportunity I have at my fingertips for small game hunting that most of the other hunters don't take advantage of. So I'm kind of blessed and cursed all at the same time with that.
We talked about that in Arizona, this notion of, if you're a small game hunter, the calendar is yours practically year round, certainly out there in Arizona and to a large extent, even in North Carolina. So I love where I live. And I love hunting and fishing across the South. And I'm fortunate that I get to travel quite a bit out in your neck of the woods and the other side of Old Man River and see what the West is all about. Back to the wild game cooking. I think that's one thing that is attracting people to the idea of wild game cooking is that in the end, it's just a celebration of where they are, of where they're rooted, and it's a celebration of the time you spend in some of your most familiar places. I love the fact that I've got still a few leftover cuts from a Maine moose in the freezer, and I've got birds from the Dakotas. But you know what? I've got wood ducks that I shot this year in a swamp where I've killed wood ducks for years and years and years, man. And when I pull that baggie out of the freezer and it says horse swamp wood ducks, man, it roots me to a place that I've seen the sun come up countless times, and there's nothing else I'd rather have on my plate.
Oh no, that's I'm a little jealous of how many wood ducks you guys actually have out there.
They're a tasty treat, I'll tell you.
They are. Not only are they gorgeous, but yeah, they're delicious. I see videos and stuff of all these wood ducks pouring down into a hole and in the east and eastern hardwoods. And I'm like, oh man, like one of these days I gotta get out there and experience some heavy wood duck hunting. I've got little pockets around here, like really small, and I get an opportunity every once in a while. But I do cherish the wood duck a whole lot when I get one on the plate. So
yeah, it's a good bird, you know. But I love all waterfowl. I love cooking all a waterfowl. I won't turn my nose up at a shoveler. I like it all. Well, maybe sea ducks, but that's a little on the edge, but everything else.
Mergansers are kind of hard for me.
Mergansers are tough. My dog, the last merganser I shot, the first merganser I'd shot in a long time, I thought, well, at least the dog will eat it. And the dog would not eat it. I cut the breast out and tossed it down there and nothing doing. I thought, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but if the dog's not going to eat it, I'm not going to try.
maybe he was looking for a little elevation in his merganser steak as well. So, well, I, you know what, Ed, I know you've got to run, but I appreciate your time. I'm glad we could connect. Hopefully, you know, if you make it back out here this way some of these times, you know, you can always drop a call. You're more than welcome in camp to hunt anytime, man.
Well, I've still got a little file going about the dove hunting that we talked about, so you might find me in your backyard before too much longer.
Oh yeah, if the best dove hunting outside of Argentina, right here in the United States. Boy, it's quite the experience. I hope we can get you out here. So, and I got to get out. Like I said, hopefully, maybe I got to lean on you to line up a wood duck, black duck hunt, maybe out there in North Carolina. So.
We can do it. Put you in a canoe and get you in the middle of them.
I'd appreciate it. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again. Hey, folks, appreciate you listening in as well. Stay tuned for the next episode of From the Backburner Podcast, and we'll talk to you soon.